headlines. A security source says a rocket has hit the Ain al-Assad air base hosting American forces in western Iraq. Iran and other signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal adjourn negotiations in Vienna for consultations in their capitals. And more world leaders congratulate Ebrahim Raisi for winning Iran's presidential election as his supporters celebrate his victory. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. An Iraqi security source says an airbase hosting U.S. forces in the country has come under a rocket attack. The source said a rocket hit the Ain al-Assad airbase in western province of Anbar. U.S. bases in Iraq have come under increasing rocket and drone attacks amid rising tensions over the continued American military presence in the Arab country. Anti-U.S. sentiments escalated following the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes back in January 2020. The Yemeni army says it has shot down an American spy drone over the province of Marib. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the drone, known as Scan Eagle, was spotted and hit while flying over Mashjar region in Marib province. He added that the UAV was brought down using a land-to-air missile. The spokesman also underlined that the Yemeni armed forces would not hold back any efforts to defend the country's skies against aggressive activities. They have shut down several American spy drones since Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies, backed by Washington, launched a war on Yemen back in 2015. The war has left tens of thousands of Yemenis dead, many of them women and children. Yemen's political leadership blames the United Nations for its apathy towards the continued Saudi violations against the children of Yemen. Yemeni officials say the UN should play its role to lift the Saudi blockade on Yemenis that causes more deaths among children instead of blacklisting the Ansarullah movement. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement blamed the United Nations for the Saudi atrocities committed against Yemeni children. The movement said the UN has always been providing the political cover-up for the Saudi war crimes. This came after the United Nations added the Ansarullah movement to its blacklist of groups for violating children's rights.
We were not surprised by this decision because the UN had removed the name of Saudi Arabia from its blacklist of the groups violating children's rights. The United Nations have not taken any real steps to protect the rights of Yemeni children who die every day due to continued blockade on food, medicine, and fuel. I believe that this is a resounding scandal for the Secretary General of the UN, who began his second term with this decision.
The member of the Supreme Political Council, Mohammed al-Houthi, dismissed as baseless the UN accusation, saying it did not refer to an investigation on the ground as the movement has demanded. Meanwhile, the Minister of Information said the UN has turned a blind eye to the ongoing Saudi blockade on Yemenis, which causes the death of tens of Yemeni children on daily basis.
This classification wasn't based on realistic data. We used to have the United Nations as a political cover for the war on Yemen and the killing of more Yemeni women and children, whether because of a continuous Saudi blockade or because of the airstrikes of Saudi fighter jets. This decision revealed to the world the true face of the United Nations, that it serves the agenda of the countries funding the UN.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war against Yemen in March 2015. The war has killed thousands of civilians, including women and children, and turned the war-torn country into the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations.
Observers say the United Nations blacklisting of Ansarullah is politically motivated and has no relation to the humanitarian situation in Yemen. They believe that the UN must take real actions against the Saudi blockade if it has real intentions to end the suffering of millions of Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
Iran's top nuclear negotiator says outstanding issues in the talks to revive the 2015 nuclear deal require serious decision-making in the respective capital of the countries involved. Abbas Araghchi made the remarks at the end of the sixth round of negotiations in Vienna. He called on the other parties to the talks to take a realistic approach and adopt necessary measures. Araghchi expressed hope that the next round of talks would produce an agreement, but stressed that there are no guarantees. The EU envoy to the talks, however, said that there were progress in the talks, but the parties adjourned the meeting for consultations in their capitals. Meanwhile, the U.S. said that there is still a fair distance to be covered on some of the key issues, including on sanctions and Iran's nuclear commitments. The U.S. is not directly involved in the Vienna talks. Our correspondent in Vienna, Homa Oleski, says some challenging issues, that is, in the talks to revive the 2015 nuclear deal remain unresolved.
Mr. Araghchi, you said, put it just before the Joint Commission session today, he believes that a lot of the issues have been resolved, the remaining issues, but we have to also be clear that he didn't say that all of the major issues have been resolved. He did say that there are still some issues that need to be resolved, and they are challenging issues. From what I gather from his comments, we can't say that the issues that are remaining are just technical details that can be worked out quickly. When he says that these are decisions that need to be made in the capitals, it implies that they are key issues, some of the most serious issues that need to be worked out. And we know those include, for instance, the issue of sequencing, because Iran has made it clear that it will only go back to full commitment after the U.S. has removed all of the sanctions. Is this going to be a step-by-step process, something that Iran has said it will not accept? Is there going to be some kind of verification that Iran would accept when it comes to sanctions removal, and how long would this verification will take? These are all issues that have been up for discussions over the past weeks and months now, and none of the sides have come and spoken in detail and, you know, directly about these issues and whether there has been an agreement on them. But as long as there's an agreement on all issues, then there's no agreement at all.
Now, congratulations are pouring in for Ebrahim Raisi on winning Iran's presidential election. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro has expressed hope for further boosting ties and cooperation between Caracas and Tehran during Raisi's presidency. The Cuban president has also wished success for Raisi in carrying out his duties, and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi also congratulated Raisi and said that he looks forward to working with him to strengthen ties. Leaders of other countries, including Russia, Pakistan, Turkey, Iraq, Azerbaijan, Armenia, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates, have already offered felicitations to the Iranian president-elect.
Iran's judiciary chief Sayed Ebrahim Raisi has won Iran's 2021 presidential election by a landslide. He managed to secure nearly 18 million of the votes and become the eighth president of the Islamic Republic. Some 29 million Iranians voted in Iran's 13th presidential election. Raisi won the presidential race amid an all-out political and media war led by the United States and its Western and regional allies targeting the event. The Islamic Republic's opponents attempted to portray a gloomy picture of the polls to discourage popular contribution. However, the Iranian people foiled the enemy's plots, as the turnout was beyond their perceived low notion. Also, the public reception forced officials to extend the time limit on the election, with polls remaining open until past midnight. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, praised the epic turnout in Iran's 13th presidential election. The leader said the high turnout neutralized the campaigns launched by the enemy's media outlets and ill-wishers to create voter apathy in the election. Ayatollah Khamenei said nothing could break the Iranian nation's will and disrupt the election. Meanwhile, the outgoing Iranian president Hassan Rouhani met president-elect Ebrahim Raisi in person to congratulate. The outgoing president stated his full support for his successor and stressed his willingness to offer assistance to the new government. In turn, president-elect Raisi pledged all-out efforts to resolve the country's problems, especially those affecting the people's livelihoods. Raisi noted that he would consult with the outgoing administration, parliament, and the elites to achieve the goal. Iran's president-elect Ebrahim Raisi received congratulatory messages from several world leaders for winning Friday's presidential election, including Russian President Vladimir Putin, who expressed hope for further development of constructive cooperation between Moscow and Tehran. Raisi will take office in 45 days. He has promised to form a hard-working, anti-corruption and revolutionary cabinet and fight corruption and uproot poverty.
You know, we can say that the main and the only loser in this election was were those who actually were discouraging people from going to the ballot boxes and turn out to vote. And either if those politicians inside Iran or those dissident Iranians outside Iran, in some cases who attacked actually the voters against the law. So they were the main losers because they were trying to discourage people to turn out, to say that people are not supporting the government, and that means that there is lack of legitimacy, and because of that, the government should not be respected in the country, they're respected actually, being recognized in by other countries.
President-elect Ebrahim Raisi is set to take over at a critical time as Iran is in talks with world powers over the JCPOA. Raisi has said that his government would not allow the economy to be conditioned by the fate of the sanctions removal talks. With or without the deal, Iran will move on and progress. Based on one of his campaign promises, he has indicated that he will focus on Iran's domestic production to boost the economy.
Sixty-year-old Ebrahim Raisi will take office in August. He is the eighth president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Raisi has promised to fight corruption and uproot poverty. He campaigned with the slogan, "Popular Administration, Strong Iran," on a platform of uprooting corruption in the executive branch, fighting poverty and inflation, and creating jobs. President-elect Raisi is set to take power at a critical time as Iran seeks to salvage its tattered nuclear deal with major powers and free itself from illegal and inhumane U.S. sanctions that have driven a sharp economic downturn. Washington has been using sanctions as a weapon by preventing Iran from buying even its necessities and blocking the country's access to its overseas financial resources. Ebrahim Raisi had stated before that he would vigorously pursue efforts to get rid of sanctions imposed by the United States. He had said that his government would not allow the economy to be conditioned by the fate of sanctions removal talks, adding that Iranians want the economy to be stable.
You know, first, either the Americans lift the sanctions or not, Iran is going to diversify its basket of diplomacy and foreign policy and relations with other countries. So Iran has signed a memorandum of understanding for 25 years with China, is working on something similar to that with Russia and with some other countries. And it means that Iran is going to move forward and move on from the JCPOA and do not rely only on that. It's not the basket to put all the eggs on that.
President-elect Ebrahim Raisi has vowed to pursue sanctions removal efforts. He has noted that one should not deal abjectly with those who want to trample over the rights of the Iranian people. With him being the president, Washington is faced with a choice. remove all sanctions, and return to compliance if it truly wants to save the nuclear deal, or follow the path of its past, confrontation, and threats. Meanwhile, Iran has forged strong ties with both Russia and China, and will proceed with its agenda with or without the U.S.
Mustafa Ghani, head of the Scientific Committee of Iran's National Headquarters for Combating the Coronavirus, earlier joined us with his take on the domestic vaccine production and the vaccination campaign. Let's take a listen.
We will be able to start the mass vaccination program from November of this year with domestic vaccine. Also, the speed of the vaccination will depend on various factors. And by domestic vaccine, domestic production, in November we will go through the mass vaccination. And I think by considering the number of vaccination in each day, it will take 2 or 3 months for completion of the vaccination inside Iran.
India has registered its lowest daily coronavirus cases in nearly 3 months. The country reported more than 58,000 new COVID infections in the past 24 hours, bringing the total caseload to 29.9 million. The overall fatalities, however, are around 400,000. The new daily infections in India dropped recently after a surge in April and May. Daily infections reached their peak of more than 400,000 last month. Strict lockdowns and mass vaccine rollouts have helped contain the surge. The country now has the second largest caseload and the third highest death toll in the world. And with that, we come to the end of another edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The 25 richest Americans pay little to no taxes thanks to leveraging loopholes in the tax code, according to a report from ProPublica released recently. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Alexis Goldstein, reporter. This article is published under the heading 25 Richest Americans Pay Few Taxes, Partly Thanks to the Family Fund Loophole. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The 25 richest Americans pay little to no taxes thanks to leveraging loopholes in the tax code, according to a report from ProPublica released recently. Billionaires like Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, and Michael Bloomberg are able to pay so little because of policy decisions that result from the lobbying pressure of large corporations like the ones these billionaires run. The problems include the lack of a U.S. wealth tax and the fact that labor is taxed at a higher rate than investment. But to add insult to injury, as the ultra-wealthy take advantage of the fact that capital gains on investments are taxed at a far lower rate than incomes, they are building portfolios of investments that further increase their political power and more deeply entrench inequality. The wealthy have many options to further increase their wealth, including investment in hedge funds, private investment funds which charge high fees but hold out the promise of returns better than the overall stock market. The 2010 Dodd-Frank Act created new rules of the road for hedge funds, including new transparency into what they own. Once a quarter, they must report certain positions on a form called 13F. But family funds, in which only the wealth of a single family is invested, lack this same level of transparency as they were carved out of the Dodd-Frank Act. Many of the billionaires ProPublica found are paying little to no taxes, are also growing their wealth through family investment offices. Family funds have been in the news this year following the spectacular blow-up of Archegos Capital. Archegos, created in 2013 by former hedge fund manager Bill Huang, 1 year after he settled charges of insider trading with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, made a series of increasingly risky fortunes that the price of about a dozen stocks would keep rising. He used money borrowed from some of the biggest banks to amplify these fortunes. When these fortunes went south and he couldn't pay the banks what he owed, it led to an estimated $10 billion in losses across the banks, with Credit Suisse taking the biggest hit, $5.5 billion. The lack of public reporting on Archegos positions contributed to the fact that none of the banks knew until it was too late that they were all on the same side of the same bad trade. Archegos wreaked havoc at the largest banks with a fund worth an estimated $20 billion. Amazon founder and executive chairman Jeff Bezos runs a family fund that's even larger. Bezos Expeditions was estimated to be worth a staggering $107 billion in 2020. Bezos Expeditions is described by Crunchbase as a family investment office that manages Bezos venture capital investments. It was through Bezos Expeditions that Bezos purchased the Washington Post and created a private space travel firm, Blue Origin. But Bezos Expeditions has a host of other investments in companies further entrenching the gig economy. Bezos Expeditions' website discloses some of its other select investments, which include home sharing app, Airbnb, which has been accused of skirting state hoteling laws and of displacing long-term residents, and ride-sharing app Uber, which has fought laws of classify its drivers as employees. Bezos Expeditions also invested in Nextdoor, which in some cities has become a sort of crowdsourced private surveillance network. Martins and Ross Martins noted for Wall Street on Parade, Bezos Expeditions has never filed a single 13F form with the SEC. This means the general public has no transparency into which stocks or options he holds. But Bezos is still able to take advantage of losses on his investments, and by disclosing those losses to the IRS, he paid no taxes in 2011, despite having a personal net worth of $18 billion. Microsoft founder Bill Gates also has a family investment office, K Cascade Investments LLC that has allowed him to amass the largest private ownership of farmland in the U.S. Gates and Melinda French Gates altogether own 269,000 acres of farmland through companies that all link back to Cascade Investments. Gates may have attempted to add even more secrecy to these purchases by using a series of limited liability shell companies. An NBC News investigation found that Cascade Investments bought farmland using at least 22 limited liability shell companies across the United States. John S. Cordman, a Georgia farmer and landowner, told NBC News that he discovered by searching property records that companies buying multiple tracts of land in Georgia were all a shell of a shell of a shell company investing for Bill Gates. This raises questions about concentration of power over farmland from the same man who made his fortune through inadequate antitrust enforcement, leading to Microsoft's concentration of power in the PC business. Michael Bloomberg also has a family investment office called Willett Advisors. Capro Asia estimated that in 2020, Willett Advisors worth $25 billion, which would make it the seventh largest family office in the world. Wallace Rayton Parade noted that the last Form 13F the firm files dates back to 2014, when the fund had a mere $273,000 in assets. Elon Musk appears to have used his family investment office, Accession LLC, to buy up some $100 million in property in California around his mansion. Limited liability companies with ties to Musk purchased six houses across two streets in the wealthy Bel Air neighborhood of Los Angeles. At least one of those LLCs share a P.O. box with Accession LLC, Musk's family office, the Wall Street Journal reported. While reporting has given us some insights into what these families' funds are doing, regulations don't require the sorts of disclosures that hedge funds must make, allowing family offices' investments to largely remain in the shadows, providing yet another benefit to the billionaires of the nation. Today's tax code incentivizes the nation's billionaires to plow as much of their money as possible into investments in these family funds, further amplifying their wealth and giving them larger influence over the political process. With these investments, they seed companies like Uber that fight against workers' rights or buy up farmland, making it harder for smaller farmers to compete. To her credit, House Financial Services Committee Chairwoman Maxine Waters has proposed draft legislation requiring family funds managing more than $750 million to provide disclosures about their investments. Broader legislation, including a wealth tax, is sorely needed to address the inequalities that family funds create. Waters' bill is a good start. Bringing more transparency into family offices could be an important first step for Congress to tackle this sprawling problem.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. In the first part, we saw how Lorna Tychovtsev made her first trip to Iraq just before the start of the war to reveal the humanity of Iraq's citizens through her photojournalism. Consequently, her attempt to enlighten the American public turned to controversy as Fox News broadcasters called her efforts, quote, villainous and even bordering on treason, and accused her of aiding and abetting the enemy on the brink of war. But Lorna was never intimidated by such words. Instead, she continued her efforts to report stories that go beyond mainstream media coverage, and during her trips to Iraq, she endeavors to get as close to the people as possible and find her way to the ordinary people in the streets of Iraq. Well, stay with us for the second part of our documentary.
It appears that there were not weapons of mass destruction there.
You said you knew where they were.
I did not. I said I knew where suspect sites were, and
you
we were just...
You said you knew where they were, near Tikrit, near Baghdad, and north, east, south, and west of there. Those are your words.
We flew back, and we spent 6 weeks living in an unprotected hotel, talking to as many Iraqis as possible, traveling in taxi cabs and in people's cars, people who started to befriend us after a while. This particular camp kind of adopted me because I would keep going back. A lot of journalists go to Iraq, they get the sexy story, they go home, they write about it, they never go back. These people, I usually go visit everyone. I try and visit everyone I've spoken to, like, you know, different people who I've had conversations with on each trip to see how they're doing, get a recap. They invited me to their eldest son's wedding, and this was wild. I mean, we had my interpreter and I and the videographer arrived at this SWAT camp. And all these women were all dolled up in this back room, and they put the Arabic music on, and you know, they have the kerchiefs, and we're doing the dance, and we're just having like this blast. The Iraqi people are good-looking people. They love to look good. They're very fashionable. This is in a SWAT camp. These people are obviously very poor, but they're still, if they have only one set of clothes, they wash it every night. They go out, and they like love to look good. Happiest when I'm there, you know, really, because you know you're doing your work. I feel like you're making some progress. You're helping the world a little bit. Don't you think this building needs some work?
Yeah.
It's a big surprise. He's 90 years old. He's still working.
I think of those young and old people who we've impacted each other. They've taught me so much about their culture, about life in Iraq. They've allowed me an insider's glimpse.
I really had a great day. You will never believe the miracle that happened. We were waiting for a taxi across the street from the hotel. Suddenly, this taxi rolled slowly over to us, as if by magic. And the guy driving was the man in the photo walking with crutches with one leg. And he remembered me taking his photo, so we made arrangements for him to come to the hotel and see his picture. Did you know that at the last minute, I grabbed my box of huge 20 by 24 photos? Yes, and I did have them here with me, and I can show people the photos. I gotta go now. My battery got fried yesterday, and the electricity came on. I had no surge protector hooked to it. Much love to you, my sweetie. I'm missing you all the day long and talking to you in my heart. I miss you and love you very much. Love, Muma.
I have Commando Mommy photos, Liz. Where? I'm looking for them right now.
Commando.
We went over to Olive's house, and they wrapped me in a...
I want to be your president for 4 more years to make our future brighter and better for every one of our citizens. I want to be your president for 4 more years to make our country safe.
The Republican message is going to be, these are dangerous times, and President Bush will protect you.
And, you know, this is what we should be doing, and taking it to whatever degree we have to take it to. Getting arrested is not such a big thing when people are dying.
If
we are a representative democracy and we supposedly have control over our government, what are we going to do about it?
Attendance is estimated between 100,000 and 300,000 people, though no official figures have been released. Overall, the march, peaceful, except for some altercations. So far, police report 134 arrests.
2005, I went back for the first election, and I almost got killed a couple of times. I was only actually in the country for 10 days, and I didn't go back for a couple of years because I was terrified. I was caught in a crossfire shootout, and, you know, here I am, an unarmed American woman traveling, you know, with cameras. And I would think, I must have been crazy coming here and walking on these streets.
Every night at the hotel, darkness would come, and you'd hear, like, the machine gun fire out in the street or handgun fire out in the street, or sometimes they were, like, fighting each other. I don't know what was going on. Everywhere we went, there were guns. You can hear, like, them clicking the guns in the background. They're loading them, checking the clips. There's nothing like the sound of a Kalashnikov being loaded.
It was kind of like, no attitude. You're not killing us today. And if you want to kill us, go ahead. Try. It was like, it was so intense. Like, gunfire broke out at one point, and no one left. Like, people refused to move, even though there was someone was shooting a gun at them. They told us, like, we went to the first polling place. They said, no, you cannot take any pictures of the National Guard or the police. So, yes, I'm not going to break the rules. Soon, everybody wants me to take their picture. The policeman in charge, he said, here, take my picture. He took someone's kid. He was kissing the kid. He said, I want you to take my picture.
Now, remember, this last trip was very dangerous for me. I had to wear hijab the entire time and my abaya. My camera bag was a hidden woman's bag where I had, you know, and I had a press pass. I was even afraid to show that at times that someone would take me out. There were over 250 political parties. Here's the election ballot boxes. People came in, they voted. And that's the other thing, a lot of political parties suddenly popping out of the woodwork, you know, because, oh, now we have democracy. Do we know what that means? Now we have freedom. Do we know what that means? I mean, it was a very beautiful, exciting time to see these people emerge from this snuffed out dictatorship state to be just thinking about, now we're free. The first 3 weeks there, I didn't talk, I didn't write a word. I was too afraid to, because I had to get my mind on it. I had to wrap my mind around it, and I had to open to what they were saying and not what I was feeling, or not what I went there thinking.
No one is interested in the truth. So did I want to hear that half the people in Iraq were, you know, certainly large numbers of people love Bush? No, I didn't want to hear that.
We are no killers, we are no terrorists, we are just looking for peace and beautiful life.
So what do you think should happen now? Point, I had two choices. I could have submerged myself and refused to hear them and to seek out people who supported my belief system, or I could listen to what they were saying and try to understand why they were saying it. And that's what I decided to do. And it was painful, and it was hard, and it was shocking to me. But the bottom line is, it's very complex. In fact, the first article I wrote was called Making Peace with All the Truths. It's not one truth. It's a multifaceted truth. And it may not make sense, and it's not black and white, and it's not right or wrong. It is complicated. But, you know, it doesn't fit into a soundbite, so we can't use it. And that's where I'm at. I don't know what I'm going to do. All I kept thinking the last 3 weeks I was there is I want to come home and plant my garden. Politics, the world, war.
Knowing what you know today, would you do the same thing all over again?
I think it is doubtful that without the weapons of mass destruction case, the President, the Congress, the United Nations, and those who joined us in the conflict, the British, the Italians, the Spanish, the Australians, would have found a persuasive enough case to support a decision to go to war.
I want our troops home. I want all the children of the world home and not in a war situation, okay? But we can't get the troops home now because we've opened up Pandora's box and people's lives are at risk. And it's about time. I mean, the left doesn't want to take responsibility for anything. The right doesn't want to take responsibility. We have to take responsibility. As an American, I have to take responsibility in my country. And I'm not going to abandon these people who I have gotten to know and who who are telling me we're afraid that if you guys leave, the shit's going to hit the fan.
Would you classify your work, journalism, as anti-mainstream or alternative?
I don't think I have they have a category for me. And I went to Iraq to bring home the face of the Iraqi people so that the people in my country could see who they were killing and maybe think, these are beautiful people, why would we want to kill them? Infantile idealism.
As a journalist, what are you going to do? Are you prepared for dying?
You can't go there unless you accept that you may not.
My name is Lorna Tychastev. I'm an editor, writer, and photojournalist. I've been working in and out of Iraq now since February 2003. I'm going to continue to name the names of the fallen from the state of New Mexico. Specialist Christopher A. Merville, age 26. Sergeant Moses Daniel Rocca, age 19.
The first time I read.
Age 30.
First 19-year-old, I had to like wait a whole minute because I didn't want to, you know, I had to.
Age 23. Private, first class, William C. Ramirez, age 19. Sergeant
Tommy L. Gray, age 34. Jaffer Hashim Majid, age 13. Wissam Hadi Duari, age 11. Daoud Kiss, age 55. Muhammad Agab, no age given. This is exactly where my photos belong, because people will see them. Ahmed Al Rifai, age 13. The face of the Iraqi people has found a home.
At some point, I realized I didn't know enough to truly report in depth on the issues that I was learning about. So I went back to school. I found a master's program at NYU in global affairs. And by that time, I had begun doing consulting work for an Iraqi NGO called Nature Iraq. Their work was to baseline the environmental conditions in the country while violence was still occurring. And I just thought that was phenomenal, and I chose that as my thesis topic. I graduated at the end of 2009, and shortly thereafter scored, you know, what I thought was my dream job, and working as a communications and outreach specialist for a USAID project in Baghdad. Their work had to do with training over 100,000 Iraqi civil servants in how to rebuild their country.
For nearly 9 years, our nation has been at war in Iraq. I'm proud to finally say these two words, and I know your families agree. Welcome home. Welcome home.
You know, my son called me a couple of days after 9/11 and said, hey, Mom, me and Mikey, we're going to sign up. We're going to go get them. And I was like, get who? As my, you know, heart stopped. And he said, we're going to get them, the people who did this. And I said, well, who did this? We don't know who did this. Who are you going to go get? Don't you think you should wait till we know who did this before you go get them? Sometimes I think I'm the one who went, so they wouldn't have to. Because I would rather it be me than them. I think I put a lot of faces where people had friendly, happy family faces to what people previously thought of as terrorists and scary and dark. And I think I was able to show a lot of people that, you know, we're not that much different. We all want basically the same things. We want a nice job so we can have a nice vacation. We want dinner on the table with our family at the end of the day. And we want to live in peace.
Thank you.
most haunting photographs and poignant stories enable her audience to share the tragedy, the struggle, the triumph of the Iraqi people. And they raise larger questions about the war, a war that was never necessary, which could have been stopped if only warmongering governments heard the voice of the people. And that's it, everyone, for this week on Aperture. Until another episode right here on Aperture, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Speaking in an interview with Fars News Agency, William Jones, journalist and political commentator, said, "The bitterness for so many Americans over the failure of the American dream has often been taken out on the latest category of immigrants, and this has led to heightened racial tensions, not only against American blacks, who have always been discriminated against regardless of how many generations their families have been here, but also against the latest batch of immigrants, now largely non-Caucasian." William Jones is a Washington bureau chief for the Executive Intelligence Review and a non-resident fellow of Chongqing Institute for Financial Studies, Renmin University of China. This interview is published under the heading U.S. Admins Promoting Hate Crimes Against Asian Americans. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Speaking in an interview with Fars News Agency, William Jones, journalist and political commentator, said, "The hate crimes against Asian Americans has no doubt been promoted by the tremendous anti-China bias exhibited by both the Trump and now the Biden administrations. People do not understand China, and therefore they do not understand Chinese culture. It appears alien to many Americans. And unfortunately, the closing of the Confucius Institutes and the increased restrictions on Chinese citizens coming to the U.S. has inhibited Americans from acquiring a greater understanding of China and the Chinese. The gun culture in the United States of America is a perennial problem that is simply getting worse." Political commentator added, "Many people and many legislators have wanted to do things to restrict the proliferation of guns, in particular automatic weapons, with mixed results. The fact that the right to bear arms is in the U.S. Constitution also makes it difficult to make any sweeping changes in the legislation without changes in the Constitution, which would be a very lengthy and difficult process to accomplish, and probably a non-starter. But it would perhaps not have much of an effect on the number of hate crimes, only the way they would be perpetrated. This is more of a cultural and educational issue and would require improving the cultural and social climate in the U.S. as well as an improvement in economic conditions, which have deteriorated through the years, causing more hardship and bitterness among the American population. The journalist and political commentator added, "The U.S. has traditionally always been open to immigrants. Nation of Immigrants has been its designation for many years. Yet, none of the immigrants have had an easy time with it, and integrating fully into U.S. society often took years, even decades, and usually only with the emergence of the second generation or third generation of those families. It has always been a fight for each new group of immigrants, and the ideal has often paled in the light of the reality. During recent years, the notion itself has come under direct attack. Part of this is due to the worsening conditions for the lower 90% of the population, and the bitterness for so many Americans over the failure of the American dream has often been taken out on the latest category of immigrants. And this has led to heightened racial tensions, not only against American blacks, who have always been discriminated against, regardless of how many generations their families have been here, but also against the latest batch of immigrants, now largely non-Caucasian." This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.